the roof system. He found he actually understood a lot about how to build a solid roof from his textbooks and from the requirements detailed in building codes. I knew from college how to design with structural steel, how to use beams and columns, he said. And the local building code spelled out what was required for steel strength, soil composition, snow-bearing capacity, wind pressure resistance, and earthquake tolerance. All he had to do was factor these elements into the business deal, which specified the size of the building, the number of floors, the store locations, the loading docks. As we talked, he was already drawing the contours for me on a piece of paper. It started out as a simple rectangle. Then he sketched in the store walls, doorways, walking space. The design began taking form. You draw a grid of likely locations to carry the roof weight, he said, and he put in little crosses where columns could be placed. The rest is algebra, he said. You solve for X. You calculate the weight of the roof from its size and thickness, and then, given columns placed every 30 feet, say, you calculate the diameter and strength of the column required. You check your math to make sure you've met all the requirements. All this he had learned in college. But he discovered there was more, much more, that they hadn't taught him in school. You know the geometric theory of what is best, but not the practical theory of what can be done, he said. There was the matter of cost, for example, about which he had not a clue. The size and type of materials he put in changed the cost of the project, it turned out. There was also the matter of aesthetics, the desires of a client who didn't want a column standing in the middle of a floor, for instance, or blocking a particular sight line. If engineers were in charge, every building would be a rectangular box, Salvia said. Instead, every building is new and individual in ways both small and large. They are complex. And as a result, there is often no textbook formula for the problems that come up. Later, for example, when he established his own firm, he and his team did the structural engineering for Boston's International Place, a landmark 46-story steel and glass tower designed by the architect Philip Johnson. The building was unusual, a cylinder smashed against a rectangle, a form that hadn't been tried in a skyscraper before. From a structural engineering point of view, Salvia explained, cylinders are problematic. A square provides 60% more stiffness than a circle, and in wind or an earthquake, a building needs to be able to resist the tendency to twist or bend. But a distorted cylinder it was, and he and his team had to invent the engineering to realize Johnson's aesthetic vision. Salvia's first mall roof may have been a simpler proposition, but it seemed to him at the time to have no end of difficulties. Besides the concerns of costs and aesthetics, he also needed to deal with the requirements of all the other professionals involved. There were the plumbing engineers, the electrical engineers, the mechanical engineers, every one of them wanting to put pipes, wiring, HVAC units just where his support columns were supposed to go. A building is like a body, he said. It has a skin, it has a skeleton, it has a vascular system, the plumbing. It has a breathing system, the ventilation. It has a nervous system, the wiring. Altogether, he explained, projects today involve some 16 different trades. He pulled out the construction plans for a 400-foot-tall skyscraper he was currently building and flipped to the table of contents to show me. Each trade had contributed its own separate section. There were sections for conveying systems, elevators and escalators, mechanical systems, heating, ventilation, plumbing, air conditioning, fire protection, masonry, concrete structures, metal structures, electrical systems, doors and windows, thermal and moisture systems, including waterproofing and insulation, rough and finished carpentry, site work, including excavation, waste and stormwater collection, and walkways. Everything right down to the carpeting, painting, landscaping, and rodent control. All the separate contributions had to be included. Yet they also had to fit together somehow so as to make sense as a whole. and then they had to be executed precisely and in coordination. On the face of it, the complexities seemed overwhelming. To manage them, Salvia said, the entire industry was forced to evolve. For most of modern history, he explained, going back to medieval times, the dominant way people put up buildings was by going out and hiring master builders who designed them, engineered them, and oversaw construction from start to finish, portico to plumbing. Master builders built Notre Dame, St. Peter's Basilica, and the United States Capitol Building. But by the middle of the 20th century, the master builders were dead and gone. The variety and sophistication of advancements in every stage of the construction process had overwhelmed the abilities of any individual to master them. In the first division of labor, architectural and engineering design split off from construction. Then, piece by piece, each component became further specialized and split off, until there were architects on one side, often with their own areas of subspecialty, and engineers on another, with their various kinds of expertise. The builders, too, fragmented into their own multiple divisions, ranging from tower crane contractors to finished carpenters. The field looked, in other words, a lot like medicine, with all its specialists and super specialists. Indeed, we in medicine continue to exist in a system created in the master builder era, a system in which a lone master physician, with a prescription pad, an operating room, and a few people to follow his lead, plans and executes the entirety of care for a patient, from diagnosis through treatment. We've been slow to adapt to the reality that, for example, a third of patients have at least 10 specialist physicians actively involved in their care by their last year of life, and probably a score more personnel, ranging from nurse practitioners and physician assistants to pharmacists and home medical aides. And the evidence of how slow we've been to adapt is the extraordinary high rate at which care for patients is duplicated or flawed or completely uncoordinated. In the construction business, Salvia explained, such failure is not an option. No matter how complex the problems he faced in designing that first shopping mall roof, he very quickly understood that he had no margin for error. Perhaps it's the large number of people who would die if his roof collapsed under the weight of snow. Or perhaps it's the huge amount of money that would be lost in the inevitable lawsuits. But whatever the reason, architects, engineers, and builders were forced long ago, going back to the early part of the last century, to confront the fact that the master builder model no longer worked. So they abandoned it. They found a different way to make sure they got things right.
To show me what they do, Salvia had me come to see one of the construction sites where he and his team were working. His firm happened to have a job underway a short, sunny walk from his office. The Russia Wharf building was going to be a sprawling 32-story, 700,000-square-foot office and apartment complex. Its footprint alone was 2 acres. The artistic renderings were spectacular. Russia Wharf was where merchant ships sailing between St. Petersburg and Boston with iron, hemp, and canvas for the shipbuilding industry once docked. The Boston Tea Party took place next door. The new glass and steel building was going up right along this waterfront, with a 10-story atrium underneath the 110-year-old brick facades of the original Classic Revival structures, preserved as part of the new building. When I arrived for the tour, Salvia took one look at my blue Brooks Brothers blazer and black penny loafers and let out a low chuckle. One thing you learn going to construction sites is you have to have the right shoes, he said. The insides of the old buildings had long been gutted, and the steel skeleton of the new tower had been built almost halfway up to the 14th floor. A tower crane hung 4 stories above the structure. Ants on the ground, we worked our way around a pair of concrete mixing trucks, the cops stopping traffic, and a few puddles of gray mud to enter the first floor field office of John Moriarty and Associates, the general contractor for the project. It was nothing like the movie construction site field trailers I had in my mind. No rusting coffee urn, No cheap staticky radio playing. No cigar-chewing boss barking orders. Instead, there were half a dozen offices where men and women, many in work boots, jeans, and yellow safety reflector vests, sat staring into computer terminals or were gathered around a conference table with a PowerPoint slide up on a screen. I was given a blue hard hat and an insurance release to sign and introduced to Finn O'Sullivan, a smiling 6'3" Irishman with a lilting brogue who served as the project executive for the building. They don't call them field bosses anymore, I was told. O'Sullivan said that on any given day, he has between 200 and 500 workers on site, including people from any of 60 subcontractors. The volume of knowledge and degree of complexity he had to manage, it struck me, were as monstrous as anything I had encountered in medicine. He tried to explain how he and his colleagues made sure that all those people were doing their work correctly, that the building would come together properly, despite the enormous number of considerations, and despite the fact that he could not possibly understand the particulars of most of the tasks involved. But I didn't really get his explanation until he brought me to the main conference room. There, on the walls around a big white oval table, hung sheets of butcher block-sized printouts of what were, to my surprise, checklists. Along the right wall as we walked in was, O'Sullivan explained, the construction schedule. As I peered in close, I saw a line-by-line, day-by-day listing of every building task that needed to be accomplished, in what order, and when. The 15th floor concrete pour on the 13th of the month, a steel delivery on the 14th, and so on. The schedule spread over multiple sheets. There was special color coding, with red items highlighting critical steps that had to be done before other steps could proceed. As each task was accomplished, a job supervisor reported to O'Sullivan, who then put a check mark in his computer scheduling program. He posted a new printout showing the next phase of work each week, sometimes more frequently if things were moving along. The construction schedule was essentially one long checklist. Since every building is a new creature with its own particularities, every building checklist is new too. It is drawn up by a group of people representing each of the 16 trades, including, in this case, someone from Salvia's firm making sure the structural engineering steps were incorporated as they should be. Then the whole checklist is sent to the subcontractors and other independent experts so they can double-check that everything is correct, that nothing has been missed. What results is remarkable. A succession of day-by-day checks that guide how the building is constructed and ensure that the knowledge of hundreds, perhaps thousands, is put to use in the right place, at the right time, in the right way. The construction schedule for the Russia Wharf project was designed to build the complex up in layers, and I could actually see those layers when Bernie Ruyard, Salvia's lead structural engineer for the project, took me on a tour. I should mention here that I am not too fond of heights. But I put on my hard hat and followed Ruyard, past the signs that said, "Warning, construction personnel only," around a rusting nest of discarded rebar, over a trail of wood planks that served as a walkway into the building, and then into an orange cage elevator that rattled its way up the side of the skeleton to the 14th floor. We stepped out onto a vast, bare, gray slab floor with no walls, just 12-foot vertical steel columns ringing the outside. A massive rectangular concrete core in the center, and the teeming city surrounding us. "You can see everything from here," Ruyard said, beckoning me to join him out on the edge. I crept to within 3 feet and tried not to dwell on the wind whipping through us or the vertiginous distance to the ground as he good-naturedly pointed out the sights along the waterfront below. I did better when we turned our backs to the city and he showed me the bare metal trusses that had been put into the ceiling to support the floor being built above. "Next," he said, "will come the fireproofers." "You have to fireproof metal?" I asked. "Oh, yes," he said. "In a fire, the metal can plasticize, lose its stiffness, and bend like spaghetti. This is why the World Trade Center buildings collapsed," he said. He walked me down a stairway to the floor below us. Here I could see the fireproofing material had been sprayed on, a gypsum-based substance that made the ceiling trusses look gray and woolly. We went down a couple more floors, and he showed me that the skin of the building had now been hung at those levels. The tall, shiny glass and steel exterior had been bolted into the concrete floors every few feet. The farther down we went, the more layers had advanced. One team of subcontractors had put up walls inside the skin. The pipe fitters had then put in water and drainage pipes. The tin knockers followed and installed the ventilation ducts. By the time we got down to the lowest floors, the masonry, electrical wiring, plumbing, and even some fixtures like staircase railings were all in place. The whole intricate process was astounding to behold. On the upper floors, however, I couldn't help but notice something that didn't look right, even to my untrained eyes. There had been rain recently, and on each of the open floors, large amounts of water had pooled in the same place, up against the walls of the inner concrete core. It was as if the floor were tilted inward, like a bowl. I asked Rouillard about this. "Yeah, the owners saw that and they weren't too happy," he said. He explained what he thinks had happened. The immense weight of the concrete core, combined with the particular makeup of the soil underneath, had probably caused the core to settle sooner than anticipated. Meanwhile, the outer steel frame had not yet been loaded with weight. There were still 18 stories to be built upon it. And that's why he believes the floor had begun to tip inward. Once the steel frame was loaded, he fully expected the floor to level out. The fascinating thing to me wasn't his explanation. I had no idea what to make of his answer. But here was a situation that hadn't been anticipated on the construction checklist. The tilting of the upper floors. At a minimum, a water cleanup would be needed and the schedule adjusted for it. That alone could throw the builder's tidy plans off track. Furthermore, the people involved had to somehow determine whether the tilting indicated a serious construction defect. I was curious to know how they handled this question, for there was inevitable uncertainty. How could they know that the problem was just ordinary settling, that loading the steel frame would in fact level out the floor? As Rouillard acknowledged, variances can occur. This was a situation of true complexity. Back down in the field office, I asked Finn O'Sullivan how he and his team dealt with such circumstances. After all, skyscraper builders must run into thousands like it, difficulties they could never have predicted or addressed in a checklist designed in advance. The medical way of dealing with such problems, with the inevitable nuances of an individual patient case, is to leave them to the expert's individual judgment. You give the specialist autonomy. In this instance, Rouillard was the specialist. Had the building site been a hospital ward, his personal judgment would hold sway. This approach has a flaw, however, O'Sullivan pointed out. Like a patient, a building involves multiple specialists. The 16 trades. In the absence of a true master builder, a supreme all-knowing expert with command of all existing knowledge, autonomy is a disaster. It produces only a cacophony of incompatible decisions and overlooked errors. You get a building that doesn't stand up straight. This sounded to me like medicine at its worst. So what do you do? I asked. That was when O'Sullivan showed me a different piece of paper hanging in his conference room. Pinned to the left-hand wall opposite the construction schedule was another butcher block-sized sheet almost identical in form. Except this one, O'Sullivan said, was called a submittal schedule. It was also a checklist, but it didn't specify constructions tasks. It specified communication tasks. For the way the project managers dealt with the unexpected and the uncertain was by making sure the experts spoke to one another on X date regarding Y process. The experts could make their individual judgments, but they had to do so as part of a team that took one another's concerns into account, discussed unplanned developments, and agreed on the way forward. While no one could anticipate all the problems, they could foresee where and when they might occur. The checklist therefore detailed who had to talk to whom, by which date, and about what aspect of construction. Who had to share, or submit, particular kinds of information before the next steps could proceed. The submittal schedule specified, for instance, that by the end of the month, the contractors, installers, and elevator engineers had to review the condition of the elevator cars traveling up to the 10th floor. The elevator cars were factory constructed and tested. They were installed by experts. But it was not assumed that they would work perfectly. Quite the opposite. The assumption was that anything could go wrong, anything could get missed. What? Who knows? That's the nature of complexity. But it was also assumed that if you got the right people together and had them take a moment to talk things over as a team, rather than as individuals, serious problems could be identified and averted. So the submittal schedule made them talk. The contractors had to talk with the installers and elevator engineers by the 31st. They had to talk about fire protection with the fireproofers by the 25th. And 2 weeks earlier, they had been required to talk about the condition of the core wall and flooring on the upper floors, where the water had pooled, with the structural engineers, a consultant, and the owners. I saw that the box had been checked. The task was done. I asked Rouillard how the discussion had gone. "Very well," he said. Everyone met and reviewed the possibilities. The owners and the contractors were persuaded that it was reasonable to expect the floor to level out. Cleanup was arranged, the schedule was adjusted, and everyone signed off. In the face of the unknown, the always nagging uncertainty about whether under complex circumstances things will really be okay, the builders trusted in the power of communication. They didn't believe in the wisdom of the single individual, of even an experienced engineer. They believed in the wisdom of the group, the wisdom of making sure that multiple pairs of eyes were on a problem and then letting the watchers decide what to do. Man is fallible, but maybe men are less so. In a back room of the field office, Ryan Walsh, a buzz-cut young man of about 30 wearing a yellow reflector vest, sat in front of two big flat-screen displays. His job, he explained, was to take all the construction plans submitted by each of the major trades and merge them into a three-dimensional floor-by-floor computer rendering of the building. He showed me what the top floor looked like on the screen. He'd so far loaded in the specifications from 9 of the trades, the structural specs, the elevator specs, the plumbing specs, and so on. He used his mouse to walk us through the building as if we were taking a stroll down the corridors. You could see the walls, the doors, the safety valves, everything. More to the point, you could see the problems, a place where there wasn't enough overhead clearance for an average-sized person, for example. He showed me an application called Clash Detective that ferreted out every instance in which the different specs conflicted with another or with building regulations. If a structural beam is going where a lighting fixture is supposed to hang, the Clash Detective turns that beam a different color on screen, he said. You can turn up hundreds of clashes. I once found 2,000. But it's not enough to show the clash on the screen, he explained. You have to resolve it. And to do that, you have to make sure the critical people talk. So the computer also flags the issue for the submittal schedule printout and sends an email to each of the parties who have to resolve it. There's yet another program, called Project Center, that allows anyone who has found a problem, even a frontline worker, to email all the relevant parties, track progress, and make sure a check is added to the schedule to confirm that everyone has talked and resolved the matter. When we were back at the McNamara Salvia offices, Bernie Rouillard showed me one such email he'd gotten that week. A worker had attached a digital photo of a 12-foot steel I-beam he was bolting in. It hadn't lined up properly, and only 2 of the 4 bolts could fit. Was that all right, the worker wanted to know. No, Rouillard wrote back. They worked out a solution together, to weld the beam into place. The email was also automatically sent to the main contractor and anyone else who might potentially be required to sign off. Each party was given 3 days to confirm that the proposed solution was okay. and everyone needed to confirm they'd communicated, since the time taken for even the small fix could change the entire sequence in which other things needed to be done. Joe Salvia had earlier told me that the major advance in the science of construction over the last few decades has been the perfection of tracking and communication. But only now did I understand what he meant. The building world's willingness to apply its strategies to difficulties of considerable size and seriousness is striking. Salvia's partner, Robert McNamara, for instance, was one of the structural engineers for the Citicorp, now Citigroup building in Midtown Manhattan, with its iconic slanted rooftop. It was planned to rise more than 900 feet on 4 9-story tall stilt-like columns, placed not at the building's corners, but at the center of each side, and steadied by giant hidden chevron-shaped braces designed by William LeMessurier, the project's lead structural engineer. The visual effect was arresting. The colossal structure would look like it was almost floating above 53rd Street. But wind tunnel testing of a model revealed that the skyscraper stood so high above the surrounding buildings in Midtown that it was subject to wind streams and turbulence with forces familiar only to airplane designers, not to structural engineers. The acceptable amount of sway for the building was unknown. So what did they do? They did not scrap the building or shrink it to a less ambitious size. Instead, McNamara proposed a novel solution called a tuned mass damper. They could, he suggested, suspend an immense 400-ton concrete block from huge springs in the building's crown on the 59th floor, so that when wind pitched the building one way, the block would swing the other and steady it. The solution was brilliant and elegant. The engineers did some wind tunnel testing with a small model of the design, and the results were highly reassuring. Nonetheless, some chance of error and unpredictability always remains in projects of this complexity. So the builders reduced their margin of error the best way they knew how, by taking a final moment to make sure that everyone talked it through as a group. The building owner met with the architect, someone from the city buildings department, the structural engineers, and others. They reviewed the idea and all the calculations behind it. They confirmed that every concern they could think of had been addressed. Then they signed off on the plan, and the skyscraper was built. It is unnerving to think that we allow buildings this difficult to design and construct to go up in the midst of our major cities, with thousands of people inside and tens of thousands more living and working nearby. Doing so seems risky and unwise. But we allow it based on trust in the ability of the experts to manage the complexities. They in turn know better than to rely on their individual abilities to get everything right. They trust instead in one set of checklists to make sure that simple steps are not missed or skipped, and in another set to make sure that everyone talks through and resolves all the hard and unexpected problems. The biggest cause of serious error in this business is a failure of communication, O'Sullivan told me. In the Citicorp building, for example, the calculations behind the designs for stabilizing the building assumed the joints in those giant braces at the base of the building would be welded. Joint welding, however, is labor-intensive and therefore expensive. Bethlehem Steel, which took the contract to erect the tower, proposed switching to bolted joints, which are not as strong. They calculated that the bolts would do the job. But, as a New Yorker story later uncovered, their calculations were somehow not reviewed with LeMessurier. That checkpoint was bypassed. It is not certain that a review would have led him to recognize a problem at the time. But in 1978, a year after the building opened, LeMessurier, prompted by a question from a Princeton engineering student, discovered the change. And he found it had produced a fatal flaw. The building would not be able to withstand 70-mile-an-hour winds, which, according to weather tables, would occur at least once every 55 years in New York City. In that circumstance, the joints would fail and the building would collapse, starting on the 30th floor. By now, the tower was fully occupied. Lemessurier broke the news to the owners and to city officials. And that summer, as Hurricane Ella made its way toward the city, an emergency crew worked at night under veil of secrecy to weld 2-inch-thick steel plates around the 200 critical bolts, and the building was secured. The Citicorp Tower has stood solidly ever since. The construction industry's checklist process has clearly not been foolproof at catching problems. Nonetheless, its record of success has been astonishing. In the United States, we have nearly 5 million commercial buildings, almost 100 million low-rise homes, and 8 million or so high-rise residences. We add somewhere around 70,000 new commercial buildings and 1 million new homes each year. But building failure, defined as a partial or full collapse of a functioning structure, is exceedingly rare, especially for skyscrapers. According to a 2003 Ohio State University study, the United States experiences on average of just 20 serious building failures per year. That's an annual avoidable failure rate of less than 0.00002%. And as Joe Salvia explained to me, although buildings are now more complex and sophisticated than ever in history, with higher standards expected for everything from earthquake proofing to energy efficiency, they take a third less time to build than they did when he started his career. The checklists work. Chapter 4. The Idea. There is a particularly tantalizing aspect to the building industry's strategy for getting things right in complex situations. It's that it gives people power. In response to risk, most authorities tend to centralize power and decision-making. That's usually what checklists are about, dictating instructions to the workers below to ensure they do things the way we want. Indeed, the first building checklist I saw, the construction schedule on the right-hand wall of O'Sullivan's conference room, was exactly that. It spelled out to the tiniest detail every critical step the tradesmen were expected to follow, and when which is logical even if you're confronted with simple and routine problems. You want the forcing function. But the list on O'Sullivan's other wall revealed an entirely different philosophy about power and what should happen to it when you're confronted with complex, non-routine problems, such as what to do when a difficult, potentially dangerous, and unanticipated anomaly suddenly appears on the 14th floor of a 32-story skyscraper under construction. The philosophy is that you push the power of decision-making out to the periphery and away from the center. You give the people the room to adapt based on their experience and expertise. All you ask is that they talk to one another and take responsibility. That is what works. The strategy is unexpectedly democratic, and it has become standard nowadays, O'Sullivan told me, even in building inspections. The inspectors do not recompute the wind force calculations or decide whether the joints in a given building should be bolted or welded, he said. Determining whether a structure like Russia Wharf or my hospital's new wing is built to code and fit for occupancy involves more knowledge and complexity than any one inspector could possibly have. So although inspectors do what they can to oversee a building's construction, mostly they make certain the builders have the proper checks in place and then have them sign affidavits attesting that they themselves have ensured that the structure is up to code. Inspectors disperse the power and the responsibility. It makes sense, O'Sullivan said. The inspectors have more troubles with the safety of a two-room addition from a do-it-yourselfer than they do with projects like ours. So that's where they focus their efforts. Also, I suspect, at least some authorities have recognized that when they don't let go of authority, they fail. We need look no further than what happened after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. At 6 a.m. on August 29, 2005, Katrina made landfall in Plaquemines Parish in New Orleans. The initial reports were falsely reassuring. with telephone lines, cell towers, and electrical power down. The usual sources of information were unavailable. By afternoon, the levees protecting the city had been breached. Much of New Orleans was underwater. The evidence was on television, but Michael Brown, the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, discounted it and told a press conference that the situation was largely under control. FEMA was relying on information from multiple sources, but only one lone agent was actually present in New Orleans. That agent had managed to get a Coast Guard helicopter ride over the city that first afternoon, and he filed an urgent report the only way he could with most communication lines cut, by email. Flooding was widespread, the email said. He himself had seen bodies floating in the water and hundreds of people stranded on rooftops. Help was needed. But the government's top officials did not use email. And as a Senate hearing uncovered, they were not apprised of the contents of the message until the next day. By then, 80% of the city was flooded. 20,000 refugees were stranded at the New Orleans Superdome. Another 20,000 were at the Ernest N. Morial Convention Center. Over 5,000 people were at an overpass on Interstate 10, some of them left by rescue crews, and most carrying little more than the clothes on their backs. Hospitals were without power and suffering horrendous conditions. As people became desperate for food and water, looting began. Civil breakdown became a serious concern. Numerous local officials and impromptu organizers made efforts to contact authorities and let them know what was needed, but they too were unable to reach anyone. When they finally got a live person on the phone, they were told to wait. Their requests would have to be sent up the line. The traditional command and control system rapidly became overwhelmed. There were too many decisions to be made and too little information about precisely where and what help was needed. Nevertheless, the authorities refused to abandon the traditional model. For days, while conditions deteriorated hourly, arguments roared over who had the power to provide the resources and make decisions. The federal government wouldn't yield the power to the state government. The state government wouldn't give it to the local government. And no one would give it to people in the private sector. The result was a combination of anarchy and Orwellian bureaucracy with horrifying consequences. Trucks with water and food were halted or diverted or refused entry by authorities. The supplies were not part of their plan. Bus requisitions were held up for days. The official request did not even reach the U.S. Department of Transportation until 2 days after tens of thousands had become trapped and in need of evacuation. Meanwhile, 200 local transit buses were sitting idle on higher ground nearby. The trouble wasn't a lack of sympathy among top officials. It was a lack of understanding that in the face of an extraordinarily complex problem, power needed to be pushed out of the center as far as possible. Everyone was waiting for the cavalry, but a centrally run, government-controlled solution was not going to be possible. Asked afterward to explain the disastrous failures, Michael Chertoff, Secretary of Homeland Security, said that it had been an ultra-catastrophe, a perfect storm that exceeded the foresight of the planners and maybe anybody's foresight. But that's not an explanation. It's simply the definition of a complex situation. And such a situation requires a different kind of solution from the command and control paradigm officials relied on. Of all organizations, it was oddly enough Walmart that best recognized the complex nature of the circumstances, according to a case study from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Briefed on what was developing, the giant discount retailer's chief executive officer, Lee Scott, issued a simple edict. "This company will respond to the level of this disaster," he was remembered to have said in a meeting with his upper management. "A lot of you are going to have to make decisions above your level. Make the best decision that you can with the information that's available to you at the time, and above all, do the right thing." As one of the officers at the meeting later recalled, that was it. The edict was passed down to store managers and set the tone for how people were expected to react. On the most immediate level, Walmart had 126 stores closed due to damage and power outages. 20,000 employees and their family members were displaced. The initial focus was on helping them. And within 48 hours, more than a half of the damaged stores were up and running again. But according to one executive on the scene, as word of the disaster's impact on the city's population began filtering in from Walmart employees on the ground, the priority shifted from reopening stores to, "Oh my God, what can we do to help these people?" Acting on their own authority, Walmart store managers began distributing diapers, water, baby formula, and ice to residents. Where FEMA still hadn't figured out how to requisition supplies, the managers fashioned crude paperslip credit systems for first responders, providing them with food, sleeping bags, toiletries, and also, where available, rescue equipment like hatchets, ropes, and boots. The assistant manager of a Walmart store engulfed by a 30-foot storm surge ran a bulldozer through the store, loaded it with any items she could salvage, and gave them all away in the parking lot. When a local hospital told her it was running short of drugs, she went back in and broke into the store's pharmacy, and was lauded by upper management for it. Senior Walmart officials concentrated on setting goals, measuring progress, and maintaining communication lines with employees at the front lines and with official agencies when they could. In other words, to handle this complex situation, they did not issue instructions. Conditions were too unpredictable and constantly changing. They worked on making sure people talked. Walmart's emergency operations team even included a member of the Red Cross. The federal government declined Walmart's invitation to participate. The team also opened a 24-hour call center for employees, which started with 8 operators, but rapidly expanded to 80 to cope with the load. Along the way, the team discovered that given common goals to do what they could to help and to coordinate with one another, Walmart's employees were able to fashion some extraordinary solutions. They set up 3 temporary mobile pharmacies in the city and adopted a plan to provide medications for free at all of their stores for evacuees with emergency needs, even without a prescription. They set up free check cashing for payroll and other checks in disaster area stores. They opened temporary clinics to provide emergency personnel with inoculations against flood-borne illnesses. And most prominently, within just 2 days of Katrina's landfall, the company's logistics teams managed to contrive ways to get tractor trailers with food, water, and emergency equipment past roadblocks and into the dying city. They were able to supply water and food to refugees and even to the National Guard a day before the government appeared on the scene. By the end, Walmart had sent in a total of 2,498 trailer loads of emergency supplies and donated $3.5 million in merchandise to area shelters and command centers. If the American government had responded like Walmart has responded, we wouldn't be in this crisis, Jefferson Parish's top official, Aaron Broussard, later said in a network television interview. The lesson of this tale has been misunderstood. Some have argued that the episode proves that the private sector is better than the public sector in handling complex situations. But it isn't. For every Walmart, you can find numerous examples of major New Orleans businesses that failed to muster an adequate response to the unfolding events. From the utility corporations, which couldn't get the telephone and electrical lines working, to the oil companies, which kept too little crude oil and refinery capacity on hand for major disruptions. Public officials could also claim some genuine successes. In the early days of the crisis, for example, the local police and firefighters, lacking adequate equipment, recruited an armada of Louisiana sportsmen with flat-bottom boats and orchestrated a breathtaking rescue of more than 62,000 people from the water, rooftops, and attics of the deluged city. No, The real lesson was that under conditions of true complexity, where the knowledge required exceeds that of any individual and unpredictability reigns, efforts to dictate every step from the center will fail. People need room to act and adapt, yet they cannot succeed as isolated individuals either. That is anarchy. Instead, they require a seemingly contradictory mix of freedom and expectation. Expectation to coordinate, for example, and also to measure progress toward common goals. This was the understanding people in the skyscraper building industry had grasped. More remarkably, they had learned to codify that understanding into simple checklists. They had made the reliable management of complexity a routine. That routine requires balancing a number of virtues: freedom and discipline, craft and protocol, specialized ability, and group collaboration. And for checklists to help achieve that balance, they have to take two almost opposing forms. They supply a set of checks to ensure the stupid but critical stuff is not overlooked, and they supply another set of checks to ensure people talk and coordinate and accept responsibility while nonetheless being left the power to manage the nuances and unpredictabilities the best they know how. I came away from Katrina and the builders with a kind of theory. Under conditions of complexity, not only are checklists a help, they are required for success. There must always be room for judgment, but judgment aided and even enhanced by procedure. Having hit on this theory, I began to recognize checklists in odd corners everywhere, in the hands of professional football coordinators, say, or on stage sets. Listening to the radio, I heard the story behind rocker David Lee Roth's notorious insistence that Van Halen's contracts with concert promoters contain a clause specifying that a bowl of M&Ms have to be provided backstage, but with every single brown candy removed, upon pain of forfeiture of the show, with full compensation to the band. And at least once, Van Halen followed through, peremptorily canceling a show in Colorado when Roth found some brown M&Ms in his dressing room. This turned out to be, however, not another example of the insane demands of power-mad celebrities, but an ingenious ruse. As Roth explained in his memoir, Crazy from the Heat, Van Halen was the first band to take huge productions into tertiary third-level markets. We'd pull up with 9 18-wheeler trucks full of gear, where the standard was 3 trucks max, and there were many, many technical errors, whether it was the girders couldn't support the weight, or the flooring would sink in, or the doors weren't big enough to move the gear through. The contract writer read like a version of the Chinese Yellow Pages because there was so much equipment and so many human beings to make it function. So just as a little test, buried somewhere in the middle of the writer would be Article 126, the No Brown M&Ms Clause. When I would walk backstage, if I saw a brown M&M in that bowl, he wrote, well, we'd line check the entire production. Guaranteed you're going to arrive at a technical error. Guaranteed you'd run into a problem. These weren't trifles, the radio story pointed out. The mistakes could be life-threatening. In Colorado, the band found the local promoters had failed to read the weight requirements, and the staging would have fallen through the arena floor. David Lee Roth had a checklist, I yelled at the radio. I ran my theory about the necessity of checklists by Jody Adams, the chef and owner of Rialto, one of my favorite restaurants in Boston. In the early 1990s, Food and Wine magazine named her one of America's 10 best new chefs, and in 1997, she won a James Beard Foundation Best Chef Award, which is the Oscar for food. Rialto is frequently mentioned on national best restaurant lists, most recently Esquire magazines. Her focus is on regional Italian cuisine, though with a distinctive take. Adams is self-taught. An anthropology major at Brown University, she never went to culinary school, but I had a thing for food, as she puts it, and she went to work in restaurants, learning her way from chopping onions to creating her own style of cooking. The level of skill and craft she has achieved in her restaurant is daunting. Moreover, she has sustained it for many years now. I was interested in how she did it. I understood perfectly well how the Burger Kings and Taco Bells of the world operate. They are driven by tightly prescribed protocol. They provide tailorized assembly line food. But in great restaurants, the food is ever-evolving, refined, and individual. Nevertheless, they have to produce an extraordinary level of excellence day after day, year after year, for 100 to 300 people per night. I had my theory of how such perfectionism is accomplished, but was it true? Adams invited me in to see. I spent one Friday evening perched on a stool in Rialto's long and narrow kitchen amid the bustle, the shouting, the grill flaming on one side, the deep fryer sizzling on another. Adams and her staff served 150 people in 5 hours. That night, they made a roasted tomato soup with sweated onions and garlic, squid ink ravioli filled with a salt cod brandade on a bed of squash blossoms and lobster sauce, grilled bluefish with corn relish, heirloom tomatoes and pickled peppers, slow-roasted duck marinated in soy sauce, balsamic vinegar, mustard, rosemary, and garlic, and 36 other mouth-watering dishes. Sitting there, I saw remarkable expertise. Half of Adams's staff had been to culinary school. Few had less than a decade of experience. They each had a kitchen specialty. There was a pastry chef, baker, grill chef, fry cook, dessert chef, sous chef, sommelier. You get the picture. Through the years, they had perfected their technique. I couldn't fathom the subtleties of most of what they did. Though I am a surgeon, they wouldn't let me anywhere near their knives. Jay, the pasta chef, showed me how to heat butter properly and tell by sight when gnocchi were perfectly boiled. Adams showed me how much a pinch of salt really was. People celebrate the technique and creativity of cooking. Chefs are personalities today, and their daring culinary exploits are what make the television cooking shows so popular. But as I saw at Rialto, it's discipline, uncelebrated and untelevised, that keeps the kitchen clicking. And sure enough, checklists were at the center of that discipline. First there was the recipe, the most basic checklist of all. Every dish had one. The recipes were typed out, put in clear plastic sleeves, and placed at each station. Adams was religious about her staff's using them. Even for her, she said, following the recipe is essential to making food of consistent quality over time. Tacked to a bulletin board beside the dessert station was what Adams called her kitchen notes, emails to the staff of her brief observations about the food. The most recent was from 12:50 the previous night. Fritters, more herbs, more garlic, more punch, it said. Corn silk in corn.